You heard a little bit about Dave and Jeff's excellent adventure from Jeff, but I wanted to talk about it a little bit more because it was my first prison visit. And about a week ago, I got a call from a friend whose friend is the mother of this boy, 26-year-old boy, kid, he's a boy to me, who is incarcerated for possession and for theft. He got a 30-day sentence. He's got a 3-year sentence hanging over his head, though, if he doesn't keep to the toe the line of probation and everything that's expected of him from this point on. And he's going to be in there for just another week. And so my friend asked me to please go see him. His mother was asking my friend, is there anybody who can go talk to him? You know, she's kind of at her wit's end. She didn't hear from him for the first week that he was in. And she was just devastated. And any of you who are parents can imagine what that might feel like. I called her and talked to her on the phone for about 45 minutes. And there was just so much pain in her voice, just so much that she was dealing with, so much we're dealing with. Okay. But the thing that impressed me so much was that she's a mother and she wants the best for her kid. She doesn't know what to do necessarily, and that's why she was reaching out. And of course I told my friend, yes, I will definitely go. And then I thought, oh no, what do I do? You know, I got a name, I got a booking number, I got nothing else. I don't know what to do. I can Google the central jail in Santa Ana and I can drive down there. So I called Jeff, knowing that he had a little more experience with these things, and said, do you have any words of wisdom? And he said, yes, I do, and I'll go with you. Yeah, praise God. And so we drove down together. And I don't know how many of you have had the experience of visiting someone in jail, but it is an experience. And I'm still processing it myself and working through it. But there was a couple aspects that I just, it's amazing how that works sometimes, that fit directly into what it is that I wanted to say this morning anyway. And so we arrived at the jail, and you're presented with this tinted bulletproof glass with a little speaker that you speak through. And there's this unsmiling guard back there, humorless unsmiling guard. And all you can really see is a uniform, a badge, and maybe lips, nothing else. I mean, everything else is just kind of hooded and shaded back there. And they ask you for the booking number. They, you know, confirm the name. And they tell you where to go, and they shuttle you off. And so we're walking down these long hallways into this visiting area, and we get to a T-intersection, and the men's jail is this way, and the women's jail is that way. So we go to the men's jail, and there's another piece of bulletproof glass there with another unsmiling guard, and he takes our ID and checks us in. And in the waiting room, there were benches that you could sit at, but what you're presented with is this long wall with about at least 20 doorways. No doors, just openings. And over each opening is a sign with a range of numbers. And we were given window 31. And so we find our slot and we walk in. And you're walking into this long, narrow hallway. But it just ends at the end. So it's almost like a long, narrow walk-in closet. And on either side is just a row of windows, more bulletproof glass, you know, inch-thick stuff. And what I couldn't get over is, on one hand, it was kind of like the movies, when you see a prison visit at the movies, but a lot less glamorous, a lot more crowded, and a lot less privacy. I was amazed. You sit down, and you're literally touching the people on either side of you. And all that you have is a narrow counter in front of you, enough to kind of rest your elbows on, and these two short panels, just the width of the counter, maybe come out 10 inches from the wall. And that's it. And you're sitting there, it's almost like I've seen scenes in the military where you got a row of toilets with no partitions between them. That's how you feel like. You just feel so exposed. And you're sitting here, and all, as Jeff said, all these conversations are going on around you. And right next to us was a pair of young Hispanic girls, I'd say early 20s. And they were just excitedly jabbering on and talking to each other. I asked them how long they've been waiting. They said 45 minutes. I guess we're going to be here a while. So I kind of settled in, turned around in my seat, and just sat there, and I'm just taking this all in. And these two girls are there. They're talking to each other just like they were in the mall or something, just jabbering along, happy and joking and laughing. Next to them was this huge other Hispanic man with a t-shirt that said something that he belonged to some group, I couldn't tell. But he's talking in this big booming voice in Spanish. You can tell he was kind of a mentor, kind of a counselor, was used to dealing with large groups, you know. And so he was there kind of in that mentor capacity. There were several young women all dolled up, you know, nice hair, makeup, good dress. Obviously they were there to meet their boyfriends and they were there on their, looking their best. And, there was another woman with about a 3-year-old daughter who was running around and kind of playing between the seats. And then there were older people and, that were obviously parents or grandparents. It was just like everything that you could imagine, every type of person kind of all thrown together. And as I sat there and I looked through the window opposite me, I realized I was seeing down dozens of hallways. All these hallways just kind of line up together. It's almost like interlocking fingers where the prisoners come in from the jail side and then interspersed and alternated the other hallways for the visitors come in from the other side. And you could literally look down. It was almost like putting two mirrors together where you see that image of going into infinity. That's how it looked. You're just looking down these mirrors way down and you're seeing row after row after row. You know, you're seeing the back of the person in the first row and then the face and then the back and the face as you go down and look at this stuff. Whenever you're presented with something for the first time, it's really interesting the impression that you take away. Sometimes when we take people down to Mexico and they see poverty for the first time, true poverty, third world conditions, some of them are devastated by the poverty that they see and they have just this heart-wrenching experience. And others see nothing but the smiles of the children and how happy they are despite the poverty that they're in. And that's what they take away. What I took away from this experience kind of surprised me. I expected there to be such pain and tears and kind of wrenching human conditions in this setting. Now, maybe if I was at a long-term prison, maybe it would have been more like that. This is the central jail, and so it's a different sort of setup. But what I found was that people were just there to see their loved ones. You know, when the guy next to us finally showed up and those two girls, they squealed and they ran over and they're trading the phone because there's only one phone and only one person can sit on this little stool thing that's kind of mounted to the wall. And so they're trading the phone back and forth and laughing and talking to this guy. And I'm seeing other conversations going on that seem so normal. And then as I'm sitting there and Jeff and I were talking and the person who was right across from me, their visit ended and some of the police would come over the intercom and tell, you know, which window, end your visit now. And they got up and left and the prisoner got up and left. And then I could see through that window into the next aisle. And so I'm looking at the back of the prisoner in his orange jumpsuit, right? And I can see the face of the person who came to visit him. And it was almost like framed like a movie. You know, the perfect over-the-shoulder shot where you're seeing the person they're talking to. And it was a young girl in her early 20s. Again, nicely made up and hair just right. And she's talking to the prisoner who only I can see his back. But they could have been having this conversation over a cup of coffee at Starbucks. They could have been having this conversation over a candlelit table in a nice restaurant. And the way that she looked at him told me, definitely, this is her boyfriend. No ring, so she wasn't a wife. But I'll tell you, a lot of guys wait a lot of years to be looked at that way by a woman. You know, to have that kind of connection, to see what he was seeing in her eyes. And the whole time that they were talking, I never saw his face. He didn't look like anything special, a little bit overweight in his jumpsuit, you know. But I never saw his face, but I could see hers. And I could see the intense connection in her eyes. And the conversation that they're having was intimate. And I started thinking about that. The only thing wrong with this girl is she's orange colorblind. She couldn't see his orange jumpsuit. She didn't care about his orange jumpsuit. She didn't care that she was talking through an inch of bulletproof glass. In fact, in that moment, she probably didn't even realize where she was anymore. She's just looking into the eyes of her man. I started to think about that. That's so incredibly wonderful on one hand. Now, on the other hand, everybody's in there because they made a victim out of somebody, right? They did something that hurt somebody. And you can say, well, you know, drug use is a victimless crime. No, not really. Look at the families of these people. Look at the mother that I just talked to of the boy that I had come to see. I don't know what this guy did, but at that moment, his girlfriend didn't care. At that moment, she was there for him. And so what I started thinking about was, regardless of where you come down on this, and regardless of the whole situation out there, whatever happened to cause that man to be in that chair, at that moment, this woman was there for him. And I'm sure that meant everything in the world to him. And so I'm sitting here waiting for this other boy to come, who I don't even know, who doesn't know me. We're going to be meeting for the first time, and I'm feeling pretty lame about that. What do I have to offer him? And I started thinking about that. All I can possibly offer is just my presence. Just to sit there and say, hey, I took several hours out of my day. I didn't tell him this, but by sitting there, it was obvious. I took several hours out of my day to be here with you. And the only thing that I can think of to tell him, beside when he finally did sit down and I looked in his eyes and I saw the pain there, you know, that kind of hooded expression where he was looking down and would only kind of dart up a glance at me every once in a while. And I felt so inadequate. You know, what do I say? And so I was introducing myself and Jeff and saying a few things to him and trying to just, you know, break the ice a little bit. And Jeff came to my rescue and let me talk to him. So he takes the phone, and as Jeff was talking to him and the common ground that they had from an addiction point of view and from other things, the ice started to break and they started to have a conversation. He started to give more than just one word answers. And when at the end of the conversation, Jeff gave me back the phone, the thing that I wanted to tell him most was that even though you're in there, even though I really can't imagine what it feels like to be in there and how lonely you must feel, there are so many people who love you. Your mother loves you. She asked us to be here today. You've got a friend that maybe you don't even know of hers who loves you, who asked us to be here today. And you've got others around who are rooting for your success, who are there to help you. And Jeff and I are here to help you. And all the resources that we have, you know, in our faith community are here to help you. It's up to you. If you want them, they're here. And call your mom. Every phone call is gold to her. You have no idea what it means to hear your voice on that telephone. And the tears were streaming down his face even when Jeff was talking to him. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if he'll ever show up here. I don't know if he'll ever give us a call when he comes out. But at that moment, we connected for just a little while. And I started to realize about the importance of being orange colorblind. I mean, what is it that we all want anyway? What is it that we're after in life? What we really want is to have someone opposite us who doesn't see us in our jumpsuit, who doesn't care about the offense for that moment, who is willing to connect with us, to be with us, to love us, to accept us as we are, exactly as we are. It doesn't mean we don't have consequences. It doesn't mean we don't have responsibilities. It doesn't mean we don't pay for the mistakes that we make and the harm that we do. But in that moment, in that connection, to have someone look at you the way the prisoner's girlfriend looked at him is everything that we want as human beings. And the thing is that that's exactly the way God loves us. God is orange colorblind too. God doesn't care about our offenses. He doesn't care what we have done in the past. He doesn't care what we're going to do tomorrow. He cares about who we are. He cares about what all those actions and behavior create in us at this moment. He cares about that because he wants the best for us. He wants our lives to be whole and complete, to be shalom. But at every moment we meet, he's looking at us like the girlfriend of that prisoner. And that is so hard for us to understand. Because it's so hard for us to do, isn't it? How do we separate those things? How do we separate the things that people have done to hurt us, the things that people have done to hurt each other, that they have done to hurt society? They're defined by that in our minds. And that's how we see them, in their jumpsuits. If we can learn to see past that, if we can learn to see them as God sees them, then we will finally start to understand and believe how God sees us. And that is a truth that can absolutely set us free. But how do we do it? How do we become convinced of such a thing? It's just amazing when you think about it. This is exactly what Jesus is trying to do in the passage that we're looking at today. You know, we've been talking about the Sermon on the Mount. He's shown us what a kingdom person looks like. He's shown us the effect that a kingdom person has on the people and the families and the society around them. And then he started to define his mission. And that's right where we're at. In Matthew 5:17, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." And here's our target verse. "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." Whoa. What in the world does he mean by that? This verse right here, Matthew 5:20, is the topic sentence, if you will, of the entire Sermon on the Mount. If you can get this, you will get everything. If you can get this, you have taken a first step toward taking a quantum leap towards God's love. And that's another thing. Y'all know what a quantum leap is? We talk about quantum leaps. We don't really think about it. But when you're looking at those little tiny subatomic particles, quarks and muons and all these different weird things, when scientists look at those in the way that they do, and they see a trajectory and a velocity on a particle, and they think, okay, it's going here, this direction, at this speed, it's going to end up over here, and all of a sudden, it's over here. It just like winks out of existence and winks back into existence up here. That's a quantum leap. Sometimes we think we can sneak up on the eternal truths of God. Sometimes we think we can just incrementally approach something as radical as God's love, and we'll get there, piece by piece. It doesn't work that way. How do we, as finite beings, approach an infinite love that is completely orange colorblind? How do we do that? You got to take a quantum leap. At some point, you got to jump away and jump off of everything that you think you know, everything that has been true for you your entire life, and just embrace something completely different. You need to wink out over here and show up over here and see what it looks like from there and see if God isn't real in that space. This is what Jesus is trying to get us to do here, because the conventional wisdom, the common knowledge of his time, was that the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees was God-ordained. It was what God wanted us to do. And what was that righteousness? It was following the law. We talked about that last week. Following the law to the letter. Being so concerned about never breaking a law that you would put hedges and fences around them. Thousands of these hedges and fences around the law so as to never break them. And to put so much importance on these hedges and fences that they became more important than the law that they were trying to protect in the first place. And so here we are simply following rules with a system that is so burdensome that nobody knows what it says anymore. It's kind of like our tax code. Nobody knows what it says anymore. It's millions of pages long. So you got to go to the lawyers and ask them. And that's what the people did. They had to go to the Pharisees and ask them. That was a source of the power that the Pharisees had over the people. They were the arbiters of the law. They were the ones who wrote it, they were the ones who knew it, and they were the ones who dished it out in little bite-sized increments when anyone had a question. But Jesus is saying you can't get to God's love through that way. You need to take a quantum leap. You need to take this jump that surpasses. And unless you can do that, unless you can surpass that sort of thinking, that legalistic attitude, that somehow mere obedience, that somehow mere conformity, that somehow mere rule following will get you where you want to go, you will never be able to enter this state of being that I call kingdom. which is nothing more than resting in that perfect love that we're talking about. There is one principle that I think is absolutely key to starting to get what Jesus is talking about. And this is the idea of the micro and the macro. And all of the rest of chapter 5, Jesus is going to be breaking this down for us. The micro and the macro. He'll be saying something like, you have heard of old that it was said. And he will state the macro Old Testament law. But I'm telling you that. And then he's going to state a micro mode of living that surpasses that. Now, what's micro and macro? Macro is something large. Macro is a big thing or a collective, a group of something. So in our lives, macro is anything 3 or over. Put it that way. As soon as you got 3 people, you got a macro group. And that can be a country. It can be our entire planet. It can be a city, state, church, a family. 3 or over. Now we're macro. Micro is one-on-one. You and God. You and one other person. It's a micro relationship. Macro relationships are part of a group. How we live is part of a group. And micro relationships are how we live one-on-one. Now, those of you who have kids, you know that as soon as you got 3 children in a room together, all the rules change, don't they? Everything changes when you add the 3rd kid. Why? Because you have switched your context from the micro to the macro. 2 kids can play really well together. But as soon as you add the 3rd one, now all the dynamics change. Now this idea of fairness has to take place over 1, 2, 3 children. And each kid you add exponentially adds to the macro problems that you're going to face. What is the most prized possession of a macro group? The kids will tell you. Mommy, that's not fair. They're looking for fairness. The group is always looking for fairness. The group is looking for justice. The group is looking for everything to be equal between everyone in the group. Absolutely important to understand that the macro is based on justice. In order for the group to survive, what was the purpose of the law? To preserve life, to fertilize life, to vitalize life. And in order for that to happen in a macro setting, you got to have laws. Because laws are the only thing that keep it fair between everybody in the group. And then you have to have a power strong enough in the group to enforce the law for the good of everybody in the group. But what happens when we go to a micro setting? Is it the legal standing going to be the epitome of that relationship? See, everything changes when we go, and this is what Jesus is trying to tell us. In the micro relationship, the standard there is not justice, but mercy and compassion. It is not simply trying to balance scales and make an even between 2 people. It's going beyond what is fair, beyond what is just, beyond what is balanced in favor of the other. That's what Jesus is trying to say. In the micro, we need to be merciful and compassionate. In the macro, we need to be just. And if we get the 2 mixed up, everything goes haywire. And look at it from our society's point of view for a second. You know, we've got the classic clash between liberals and conservatives. Why do you think that is? It's because conservatives are focused on the macro and liberals are focused on the micro. Conservatives are focused on justice and the rule of law. Are they not? Think about it. What is the focus of a conservative bloc? On any issue you can think of. Think of capital punishment. They're going to be for it. Why? Because they're for the rule of law. What's a liberal going to do? The liberal is focused on the micro. The liberal is focused on mercy and compassion. The liberal is going to be against capital punishment. Why? Because they're looking at one prisoner at a time. They're not looking at the good of the group. To a conservative, the liberal looks unjust. Why? Because a liberal is unjust. But to a liberal, the conservative looks intolerant, looks uncaring, looks evil even. Why? Because they are focused on the group and not the individual. Classic stuff. Illegal immigration. The conservative is going to be for protecting the borders. And why? Because of the rule of law. The liberal is going to be for the individual and keeping them here? And what about those families? And you see the difference? It goes back and forth, back and forth. But you need to understand that when you take justice and put it into the micro, now you're being uncompassionate and unmerciful. And when you take mercy and compassion and put it into the macro, you're being unjust. You can't mix the two. This misunderstanding in our society accounts for so much of the problems that we have in making decisions about every issue that you can pretty much think about right now. Now think about socialism. Socialism is a mode of governing with compassion. You know, you look at the system, whether it's an aristocracy or whether it's capitalism, you say, hey, this is not fair. You got these people with lots of money and you got these people with no money. So what's the fair thing to do? Well, let's take the money from the rich people and give it to the poor. You know, quintessential Robin Hood stuff. Well, it sounds great on paper, but is it fair? Is it fair for the people who worked really hard to amass a certain amount of wealth to forcibly take it and give it to someone else? In the micro, if you voluntarily do that, it's beautiful. In the macro, if you forcibly do it, it's terrible. It's unjust. But, on the other hand, if the conservative tries to apply rules and regulations in the micro, then they are simply uncompassionate. How do you try to live a life between a husband and wife based on rules? You know? There was a movie called Sleeping with the Enemy. I don't know if you ever heard it. And that's exactly what the relationship was like. You know, this absolutely OCDC controlling husband who had to have every towel on the rack lined up just perfectly and all the labels on the cans had to be just right and the dinner had to be at this time and this and that. And she was supposed to comply with all that. Absolutely terrorized her emotionally because he was applying the rule of law to a micro relationship. If we try to do that, whether it's with, you know, this is the time dinner will start, and if you're late, you're in big trouble. You know, you got to have some leeway in micro relationships because we're trying to give more than 100%. We're trying to unbalance the scales in favor of the other. But those of you who have ever supervised a group at work, if you don't enforce the start times, the morale and everything goes out the window because you're seen as unfair. This is something we really have to understand here. We need to be able to code switch between the two. We need to see that the groups need one thing. They need justice. They need law. They need order. Micro relationships need mercy and compassion and always going more than 100%, going in favor of the other. And this is what Jesus is trying to tell us. What has the church done? And this is the unfortunate thing. The modern Christian church has flopped down either on one side or the other. And predictably, if it's a conservative church, they're focused on the macro. They're focused on law. And if it's a liberal church, then they're focused on the micro. Same thing going on here. So are liberal churches like our mainstream denominations, Episcopalians and Methodists and Lutherans, they tend to be focused on social justice, don't they? Because they're focused on getting each person what they need, regardless of what that does in the macro. But since most of us come from a more conservative background here in Orange County, think about the evangelical church. Think about the religious right. They are totally focused on the macro, on the rule of law. They're going to be focused on issues like school prayer, you know, prayer in the public square. They're going to want to establish that for the good of the macro, regardless of what that does to the rights of individual students. They're going to be focused on an issue like homosexuality. It's against the law, they say. Therefore, it needs to be abandoned. It needs to be abolished. Not thinking about individual homosexuals. This is where we get the hate the sinner. What is it? Did that wrong. Hate the sin, love the sinner. Okay? Hate the sin, you know. What does that mean? What in the world does that mean? How do you do that? I'll tell you one thing. Hating the sin and loving the sinner, if it doesn't absolutely include full and total acceptance of the other, then it's a cop-out. Nothing but a cop-out. We are called to do that. That doesn't mean that we can't do both. And that's the beauty of it. If we know that, We can have friends who are homosexual. We can enter and celebrate in their lives, and we can still oppose the political agenda of that group in the macro. We can still love and give money to and support individual illegal alien families. And yet, we can still say, but for the rule of law, for the good of the country, we need to protect our borders. We can say stuff like that. We can go visit those on death row and love them and be there for them. And at the same time, we can say, but capital punishment is the best for the group. You may disagree with that. That's okay. That's the beauty of it. But your choices need to be targeted and in the context of each of those two. If you mix them up, everything goes haywire. This starts to inform us of what Jesus is talking about here. How can he come not to abolish but fulfill the law? To say that until heaven and earth pass away, every jot and tittle, every smallest letter and stroke will be fulfilled. And yet at the same time say, unless you exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Which in the people's mind was the same thing. The righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees was the law. What is he doing? He's switching us between the macro and the micro. There is a wonderful story in Matthew 26. And I'm sure you know this one. Jesus is at the home of Simon. He's called Simon the leper, which is probably a misprint or a mistranslation of the Aramaic. It was probably Simon the barrel maker. But anyway, he's in the home of Simon the Pharisee. We can all agree on that one. Simon the Pharisee. And a woman comes to him, just totally distraught, in tears, and breaks an expensive alabaster jar of perfume and pours it all over him and anoints him and then dries his feet with her hair, and she's sobbing and crying. And what do his disciples do? They're incensed. They're indignant. The expense of this perfume, that could have been sold and given to the poor. And what does Jesus say? You will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. How insensitive of Jesus to say that. How could he not care about the poor? How could he be so flip in his response? We're always going to have the poor with you. What is he doing? He's taking them from the macro to the micro because he recognizes in so many ways when we focus on the macro, on the big global concepts, we're copping out to those people who are right in front of us. The macro focus becomes an excuse not to act in the micro. Oh, we can't possibly fix that, so let's just not do anything. When I first started working with Children of the Americas in the early 80s, we'd be crossing the border to go work with 100 or 200 children. But I knew the statistic that every single day, 50,000 children died that 24-hour period from vaccine-preventable diseases and from malnutrition. So what does it matter if I go and feed 100 kids? A whole Dodger Stadium full of kids died that same day. What difference does it make? It took me several years to work through that. I almost quit. And what's the point? You can't even touch a number like that. Today, thankfully, the number is down to about 30,000. But 30,000 kids every single day? We can't even comprehend how many kids that is. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to what I do. It doesn't matter to the child who's right in front of me that I serve, whose smile that I'm looking at. That's what's important, and that's what Jesus is trying to say. Forget about the macro. You can't do anything about that. You will always have the poor, but what she did right now will instruct you, will inform you about how nothing matters to the health and to the shalom of this relationship. The cost of that perfume was nothing in terms of what it did for me, how it prepared me for what I need to do for my burial, he says. You know, we've got to see these things. This is what Jesus is trying to tell us. And in Matthew 5:20, where Jesus says, unless you exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom. What is he doing? He's telling us that he is always going to teach us from a micro point of view. It's all that matters. Seek first the kingdom and all else will be added. Seek first the relationship and the micro and all your other relationships will get better. It doesn't work the other way. It doesn't work from the outside in. It always is from the inside out. Take care of the relationship right in front of you, and everything else will be added. If enough people did that, then society would change. That's the future vision of kingdom. If enough hearts change, if enough individual relationships change, yes, we can change the world. But it's going to be from the ground up. It's going to be from the inside out. It's not going to be the other way around. This, in conjunction with Jesus telling us that he is always going to teach from within the context of kingdom, are two central things we have to understand. Because the kingdom is a micro experience. A kingdom moment is always between you and one other, between you and God, you and one person. That's the experience of it. And Jesus is saying right here, it's all about kingdom. Everything that I tell you will be within the context of kingdom. Therefore, everything I tell you will be in the context of the micro. So as I redefine the law for you, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be switching you from this macro understanding that you have about justice and rule of law and the importance of following these laws and bring them into a micro context every single time. This is what he's trying to tell us. It's not ever about mere justice or rule following. And the difference between what Jesus is trying to tell us and the Pharisees' righteousness is the difference between this micro and macro relationship. This is our quantum leap. This is the tool, the lever that we can use within our lives to jump from here to there without anything in between, to get to a place that we never thought we could arrive, a place where God's love becomes real, where we can feel it, and more importantly, where we can do it. Because God's love will never be real to us. We will never truly have faith in God's love. We will never truly believe God's love until we are practicing God's love. All we need right now is just enough of a sense that it actually exists to desire it and to go after it. But it's not until we can actually practice it that we know, that we know, that we know that we are loved that way. That it's really real. You know, the prisoner's girlfriend had it right. Regardless of what he did, regardless of who he hurt, she was there for him. 2 weeks ago, we talked about the prodigal son. We talked about a father who had been hurt by his son beyond anything that culture could imagine, comprehend. And yet when that son came back, he was not only colorblind, he also had no sense of smell, because he comes back covered with pig feces and he just hugs him to his Sunday best, pulls him in, brings him home, kills the fatted calf, enrages the elder brother who was still living in the macro, who cannot see the beauty and the necessity of this micro relationship, can't understand it. It's not fair. I've been here all this time. But that's what Jesus is trying to show us. If we can do that, if we can look at each other and not see our jumpsuits, not see the bulletproof glass, then we can shed our own jumpsuits. And I'll tell you, I want nothing more than my wife to be able to look at me when I got my jumpsuit on the way that girlfriend looked at her boyfriend. And I want nothing more than God to look at me that way. Because guess what? I always have my jumpsuit on. And so do you. And until we learn to see others this way, we will never see ourselves that way, as loved without condition. This is what Jesus is telling us. And this is what he's going to make more and more concrete as we finish this chapter. Think about that, everybody. Think about it only so much, though, and then just take the leap. There's only so far you can go. See if you don't end up in some place completely unexpected and beautiful. Let's pray. Father, once again, if it was easy, everybody would be doing it. And so we at once recognize the difficulty of what we're trying to do, to believe in something, to apprehend something that seems so good that it can't be true. And all we want is to continue to grow towards you, to understand who you are so that we can understand who we are in you. So help us, Lord. You recognize our weaknesses, but you don't take any note. You recognize the difficulties and the harm that we do, but you accept us anyway. Help us to understand that to a point that we can accept each other, Lord, and find you in the process. We are so grateful. We're so grateful for the people around us this morning, for you and your teaching and your word and everything that just keeps pointing us tirelessly toward yourself and toward your love. Help us to heed it. Help us to find it. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Whoa. I went long again. Let's all stand and take hands. Russell's here. He snuck up on us. All right. Jeffy, where are you? Okay. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen. 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 Have a wonderful week!